Well, good evening and welcome to the Gender Institute public lecture. This lecture, which has been organised in collaboration with the Gay, Lesbian and Bisexual Society of the LSE, is to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the founding of the Gay Liberation Front. Over the last few weeks, we've had a number of people ringing up the LSE and asking in fairly kind of imperious tones, well, what's the LSE got to do with the Gay Liberation Front? And some people have been surprised, although I don't know why, to discover that the British Gay Liberation Front was actually founded in a basement seminar room of the LSE on the 13th of October, 1970. And it was, of course, based on the American GLF, which was itself a product of the Stonewall riots. Now, I won't tell you very much more about the history of the GLF, because that would be to steal the thunder of our very distinguished speaker this afternoon. We're very pleased to be able to welcome Professor Geoffrey Weeks, who is one of the foremost historians of sexuality in the United Kingdom. Professor Weeks was an early member of the GLF. He just told me that he thinks he came to the fourth meeting, perhaps. And he was at that time a researcher in the LSE, and since then he's held posts at the University of Essex, Kent, Southampton, but he is now the Professor of Sociology at South Bank and head of the School of Education, Politics and Social Science. He's written a very large number of well-known and distinguished books on the history of sexuality, but his most recent book, which has just come out, is called Invented Moralities, Sexual Values in an Age of Uncertainty. And so I'd like to welcome Professor Weeks to give this lecture.
Thanks very much. It's a great pleasure to be here on the 25th anniversary of the founding of GLF, something that profoundly changed my life and the life of many of us and many people here today. It's slightly unfortunate that some of you may know that exactly at the same time as this lecture, Andrew Sullivan is promoting his new book on homosexuality, which The Guardian's been promoting heavily all week, at the Café Royal, and perhaps the Café Royal is a salubrious place than the LSE, but for me, the LSE will always be a very important part of my experience, both as a young academic and as a place where I encountered the gay liberation movement. I'm, as Henrietta suggested, now professionally an academic, and in fact, when GLF was founded in 1970, I was a sort of proto-academic as a research assistant here. And I've made a profession of being a social scientist and a sociologist and a historian, that's as far as you can distinguish between them. So part of my lecture is really an analysis from that sort of perspective of what GLF was and is in its historical echoes. But no one who went through the experience of GLF, and least of all me, could distinguish that sort of so-called objective view of what happened from the personal experiences of what happened. Because for me, as I suggested, involvement in GLF actually profoundly changed my life and actually my academic career. Because when I first encountered GLF, I had been trained as a historian and as a political theorist. One of the reasons I was interested in GLF as a sort of, apart from my personal involvement, was what it said about theory, about political theory, about political activism, and I'll say something about that in a moment. But the most profound thing it did for me was actually to bring together the various strands of my life, my professional, my sexual, my personal, and my political beliefs, and I think it did that for many of us. It was a sort of explosive experience, and I think that sort of experience is echoed through the years. We're all familiar now with the rather hackneyed phrase, the personal is political. But for those of us involved in gay liberation, as for the early days of feminism, it was actually true. What we had experienced, what we wanted to experience, what we were experiencing, was highly political to us. What we did in bed was not simply something that was private, it was something that had political echoes. And I think that sort of sense that the most intimate things connected to us, our sexuality, our personal relationships, are more important than simply about us as individuals, but say something about the culture, say something about our history, say something about the wider society, was profoundly important to that moment of gay liberation. Unless you lived through those years, it's actually very difficult to give a very clear impression of what it was like. It was an incredibly heady experience. And I'm not going to spend a lecture trying to retell that heady experience particularly, but let me just give you a quote from Edmund White, the American gay novelist. He ends his novel, The Beautiful Room is Empty, with a description of the impact of Stonewall on his generation in 1969. He called it our Bastille, the turning point of our lives. And certainly the echoes a year later in Britain of gay liberation was the turning point of my life, and I think the turning point of many of our lives. So let me first of all say one or two things about me in 1969, 1970, and those early experiences of GLF, and then I'll go on to the wider implications. I was a student in London in 1969 when the American GLF was founded. I was ignorant, as most of us over here were, of the Stonewall riots. And when I first heard of them, which I can remember vividly, a few months after them, I really felt that this was something that couldn't possibly happen over here. There was a broadcast on the World at One on the day of the first anniversary of Stonewall, the first Pride March in New York. And I remembering, sort of shuddering, at this awful spectacle of lesbian and gay people marching on the streets of New York and thinking that could never happen here, and thank God it couldn't happen here. It was just too terrifying to my own repressed sense of sexuality at the time. And I think that was a sort of widespread generational thing. So it wasn't until GLF was actually founded here 25 years ago that I took an interest. As I said, I was actually working here at the time, and it was one of those periods in the life of the LSE, more frequent than they are now in the 1960s, early 1970s, when the school was in uproar. There was a whole series of sit-ins about various things. I've forgotten exactly what they were about, but there was a sort of heady political atmosphere here at LSE. And GLF was founded in that sort of moment. And I want to try to sort of analyse in a moment what I think that moment was. I started working here, in fact, on the 1st of October 1970. And for a variety of reasons, I missed the first few meetings of GLF. I didn't go to the first meeting until, I think, early November. And I went with great trepidation. A trepidation is difficult to sort of recreate now, but a sense of acute anxiety about what he was going to do to me. But I went to the meeting. It was perhaps a couple of hundred people by then in one of the seminar rooms. And it was an incredibly heady meeting because it brought together so many different sorts of people, which I think aren't just a randomly different group of people, but represented different sorts of strands. There were academics, there were journalists, there were media people, there were manual workers, as few then as perhaps they are now in gay activism, but nevertheless there. What happened then was, and in subsequent months for me, was perhaps not history with a capital H. I myself was a fairly passive member of those early days of GLF. I was rather intimidated by some of the superstars. Like all movements which claims not to have leaders, GLF, of course, had its natural leaders who soon emerged and then were pulled down in the general hostility to leadership. I felt myself part of the mass, the foot soldier in this new army. So it wasn't history with a capital H, but it was certainly my history. My politics, my personal relations, my living arrangements, my personal appearance. May not believe it now, but I was able then to grow my hair long. Even my career, all were challenged and transformed by those early months in GLF. And the impact and the influence are still with me. In a sense, everything I've done since, personally, politically, and career-wise, has been shaped by that. Just a few random examples which reported to me. At the first gay liberation demonstration at Highbury Fields at the end of November 1970, I met my lover, Angus, who remained my lover for 10 years after that and who I lived with until he died a couple of years ago, died of AIDS. And that's another part of the history which none of us who've lived through the last 25 years can forget. Most of my current intellectual and political preoccupations stem from that moment. It's like background radiation to my life. This was the sort of big bang of my adult life, which in a sense changed everything. And though I think many of my ideas have inevitably changed since then, I think my basic commitments stem from that moment. If I wanted to sum it up, I'd say that in 1970, 71, I reinvented myself. And although many things have changed in my life since, I think the invention that I created then, along with lots of others, is an invention of myself that I still live with. And it's important, I think, that sense of reinvention. It's a word that comes up if you read the literature of sexual politics over the last 25 years. There is this tremendous sense that what we have become is what we made ourselves. And this word invention, I've used it in my latest book, but I think it's a familiar theme. We didn't just become what we were, as if we didn't know what we were. We became something else through that experience of gay liberation. In that moment of the late 60s, early 70s, I think this was an experience that many people of my generation went through. Feminists did, black activists did. A sense that in that particularly highly charged political moment, we were able to create something new for ourselves, create new possibilities, new identities, new communities, and so on. And that's really the theme that I want to develop, because I think it's that legacy of invention, self-creation, reinvention, that is the major legacy of the gay liberation movement. But before I go on to that in more detail, let me just try to sum up what I think gay liberation did in analytical terms, because I think it brought together several distinct strands of experience that have been going on in the 60s, developing in the 60s, that came together in this explosive mix that called itself gay liberation. First of all, something was, if you lived through that moment, it's very difficult to forget, was the influence of the counterculture. It's something that now seems desperately old-fashioned, except as a style, as a fashion. Something recreated in the revival of interest in the Beatles or the Stones still marching around the world in concerts. But there was something more important than that, I think, in the late 60s. There was this sense of a revolt of a particular generation, a revolt of lifestyle, of changing one's head, of changing one's appearance, of changing the whole thing that held one to what in the language of the time we regarded as bourgeois society. Now, what I think is interesting is that for many of us, my generation, for me personally, in a sense, the counterculture of the 60s had passed us by. It seemed heavily heterosexual, it seemed very macho, it was something that was so-called sexually liberated, but as women subsequently and as gays have pointed out, it was a counterculture, a lifestyle revolution, which excluded large numbers of people who didn't fit into its norms. One of the things that gay liberation did was to bring into that sort of counterculture a whole swathe of people, lesbian and gays, who'd felt excluded from it. It was a moment when I think the counterculture touched the homosexual underground, the homosexual, the gay ghetto of the time. And it rejected it represented in some ways a rejection of certain old traditions, which continue really to be under attack in different ways, have continued to be under attack in different ways ever since, and are part of our political fabric today. The so-called challenge to the family, a greater emphasis on individualism, on individual lifestyles, choice of lifestyles. A sense of taking certain choices, certain decisions about our lives into our own hands. A sort of revolt into lifestyle. Experiments in living, in a phrase that's become more common since. There was this sense of experimenting with lifestyles. That was one particular aspect. The second aspect, which is related but not necessarily the same, were changes on the left. Because again, after 16 years how should we put it politely, conservative hegemony, it's very difficult to remember the late 60s, early 70s, when, for some, there actually did seem to be a radical rupture happening in Western society. Trade union militancy, worker militancy, revival of left movements, and so on. And although this wasn't universally true, I think a large part of the inspiration of gay liberation was a sort of more radical leftism, a challenge to certain rigid leftisms, but also a sense that new forces were coming into the progressive left. The most obvious was in the States was black politics and the rise of feminism. Gay power was seen very much as part of that wider movement, called the movement with a capital M, bringing into political discourse of the left issues which had previously been regarded as too marginal to be of concern to large-scale politics. The personal as political, as a phrase, was very important because it represented this bringing into wider political discourse what were called personal or private issues, but which became public issues and have remained public issues ever since, and that was very, very important. So it wasn't surprising in that context that one of the first public political things that GLF did in London was to go on the great TUC march in 1970 against the Industrial Relations Act. We were stuck at the back, we were very marginalised. The trade union leaders and leaders of the Labour Party had no idea what we were all about, had no conception that there was any relevance to that, and there's lots of echoes ever since of that. But nevertheless, for us, perhaps with illusion, it was important to do that. A third strand, and obviously the most directly concerned with gay liberation, was changes in the gay world itself. 1967 had seen the change of the law, which partially decriminalized male homosexuality in private. There was an opportunity and a disappointment at the same time. And I think those two things again came together in GLF. First of all, it was a disappointment in that nothing really changed, or seemed to change after 1967. In fact, the number of prosecutions increased for male homosexual offences, in the 5 years after 1967. It was simply that the tactics had changed. Nevertheless, it was an opportunity at the same time, because for the first time in British history, or I should say English and Welsh history, it came later in Scotland and Northern Ireland, it was actually legal over the age of 21 in private to be homosexual. And I think that opportunity, which those of my generation tended to minimize, we tended to despise, wrongly, I think now, the cautious politics of the leaders of the Homosexual Law Reform Society and campaigns of the 1960s. It was an important achievement. It opened the door, in a sense, opened the gates through which it became possible to do new things. Now, let me say something about what we would now call the gay community in 1970. One of the interesting things about British GLF, London Gay Liberation Front, was that, in a sense, it was quite different from American, although we tended to forget that at the time. If you look at the history of gay liberation in America, you see that, in a sense, it was the product of the growth of the gay community itself. There's lots of historical work now which shows that, in a sense, the greater openness about gay issues had been developing for 20 years or so before gay liberation. So in America, gay liberation was like the community coming out. In Britain, gay liberation was much more, at first, a revolt against the existing gay subculture, the ghetto mentality. Many of the early campaigns were actually against gay bars, against gay pubs. And it was only over the next 2 or 3 years that, in a sense, the community and the movement came together. So that coming together is an important part of the legacy, which I'll come on to. But the fourth thing I wanted to say about that moment in 1970 was that, although to us as gay people it looked like something that was peculiar to us or to our experience as gay people, we have to see it now as part of a much wider shift in Western values, I think. We have to see it as part of a greater stress on individualism, a greater flexibility in lifestyles, a greater choice of ways of living together, a part of the breakdown of traditional values of the family, and so on. What I've called since an unfinished revolution in attitudes towards sexuality. So gay liberation, in retrospect, could be seen as a product as much as a cause of what has happened subsequently, or was happening then and happened subsequently. Okay, Gay Liberation Front itself was a sort of product of that particular moment in history. And like all particular products of history, it had a brief history. I think the history of GLF in its radical phase was very much over by 1972. And in the previous 2 years, there'd been a number of splits, divisions, bits flying off in all directions. Many of the women split from the men in early GLF, for instance. The those who were into radical drag, the radical fairies, split from the Marxists, who split from the liberals. Smaller groups that had grown up around particular interests, against campaigning against psychiatry or campaigning for helplines or setting up what became Gay News or any number of different interests, began to set up different organisations which developed a history of their own. By 1972, there was no longer a sense of GLF as a single organisational forum. What there was developing was very much a sense of a movement which embraced a lot of different activities, a lot of different interests. And it's that movement, in a sense, which we are living with the legacy of today. Now, it's easy to feel nostalgia for that that particular moment in 1970-71. And I sometimes feel nostalgia for it myself. But I think it's very important to realise that it was, in a sense, the collapse of a single grouping called GLF which liberated all these different energies, these different possibilities, these different organisations. The lesbian and gay world we know today is a product of that opening up of possibilities from around 1971-72. Let me now finally then, in more detail, try to sketch out the three areas where I think the legacy of gay liberation is most important. And these are the areas of identity, the idea of community, and the idea of what homosexuality is or is about. And I'll explain what I mean by those as I go along. First of all, let's look at identity. The most famous single legacy, I suppose, of gay liberation is the idea of coming out. The idea of being open about one's being lesbian or gay. Coming out in itself is about affirming one's sexuality, affirming one's sexual choices, affirming one's own desires. Now, in a sense, this is so much part of our culture today for most lesbian and gays, that it's difficult to realise how difficult it was in 1970. What a painful process it was to be open about one's gayness. Of course, a number of individuals had been open about their gayness for decades or even centuries before. There had been a sense of self, even pride in self on an individual level before. What was significant about gay liberation is that it provided a wider context in which it became possible to be open about one's gayness. A context in which it was possible to affirm pride in one's being, lesbian or gay. And a context in which it became possible to affirm one's sense of self through involvement with others. Very important emphasis, which is often forgotten. Coming out wasn't simply an individual act, it was part of a collective act. The collective made the individual act possible. It was our collective identity that made possible the affirmation of an individual identity. And allied to that sense of identity and pride in identity was a developing sense that what we had experienced wasn't simply individual discrimination or individual pain. It was actually a collective denial of the validity of homosexuality. In other words, we came to an analysis of the idea of oppression, of gay oppression, as being deeply rooted part of Western culture. So that the denial of homosexuality was actually part of a system. It wasn't simply part of individual prejudice. A system that we later came to call heterophobia, homophobia, heterosexual dominance, or whatever. Compulsory heterosexuality. So an individual sense of self, an individual affirmation of identity became possible through collective action, which in turn became meaningful through an analysis of gay oppression. It's not surprising, therefore, that some of the earliest sort of writing of gay liberation was historical writing. I mean, that's true of my own work. My first book coming out was an examination of the history of the gay movement, of the emergence of a gay identity. It became important for that generation, my generation, to explore why homosexuality had been oppressed, to look at the forms of oppression through history, and to look at the ways in which people had resisted it. And that historical stress was very similar to the historical stress in early writings of feminism and indeed black politics. That searching for the roots of oppression, the exploration of what was hidden from history, the bringing to the surface of our experience. So we had a concept of oppression. Allied to that concept of oppression was a rejection of liberal tolerance, what Christopher Isherwood called annihilation through blandness, a rejection of toleration that didn't really accept. Now, what we've lived through over the last 25 years is a broadening of liberal tolerance in our culture, I would say. We are a more tolerant, infinitely more tolerant society, I would argue, than was the case 25 years ago. Yet that fundamental problem hasn't been resolved, that there's a sort of live and let live tolerance of homosexuality, which only in certain moments, at certain spaces, has become a full acceptance of difference. But what gay liberation put on the agenda was the desire not only to gain a sort of tolerance of us as a minority, but actually a rejection of the forms, the cultural forms, which constantly made homosexuality simply a minority experience, which simply saw it as something that was over there, not really to do with us as a majority. It was a fundamental questioning, I would argue, of the assumptions of the sexual culture. Now, through the last 25 years, of course, we've seen all sorts of changes. And most recently, we've seen the emergence of a queer politics, which has rejected, in theory at least, part of that legacy of the last 25 years, part of the achievement of that 25 years. What's interesting for me, having lived through the GLF experience and the queer politics experience, is the degree to which the rhetoric, the challenge, the desires of both movements were very, very similar. In one sense, queer politics is a revival of the radical impulse of early gay liberation. Secondly, let me look at the concept of community. As I've suggested, gay liberation wasn't simply about individual liberation, it was about collective liberation. It was about working with others, coming together, coming out and coming together in order to make it possible for individuals to be open about their gayness, but also to challenge the dominant culture, to create a space where it became possible to be openly gay and to live a gay lifestyle, lesbian and gay lifestyle, but also to provide the basis of that communal strength which made other changes possible. Now, we all know that the notion of community is a very ambiguous one. Some people deny that it exists. We always quarrel over what it means. What we call the lesbian and gay community today is split by many, many different interests between women and men, black and white, between generations, between lifestyles. There are many, many different possibilities of being lesbian or gay today than there were 25 years ago. But nevertheless, I think that sense of being involved with others, that sense that our strength comes from being more than a simple aggregation of individuals, but also having a collective experience, a collective existence, has been very important. Because I think it made possible, first of all, that affirmation of identity, which I talked about. It's become the focus of the elaboration of a whole set of values that we take for granted today around friendship, around love, around involvement with others, around caring, and so on, as well as around sex. And I think we can see the influence of that, the collective strength that has come from that sense of community in the response during the 1980s and since to the AIDS crisis. Because it's very easy to forget now that what made possible any social response to the AIDS crisis in the early 1980s was the experience of lesbian and gays working together prior to the AIDS crisis erupting. We had built up, in some sense, the collective strength, the institutions, the notion of caring and sharing with others, which made possible a social response to AIDS. And of course, it's on the basis of that collective experience of a community that it also became possible to mobilize the various political campaigns that have gone on ever since. On community issues, on health issues, and on attempts to change the law, defend people when they're prosecuted, and so on. The third broad area I wanted to raise was the whole notion of what homosexuality is. Now, homosexuality, as we know, could be many things. It could be an identity, it could be a sexual taste, it could be a lifestyle, and so on. But what's really interesting, if you go back to those early ideas of gay liberation, some of which have been echoed in queer politics more recently, is the idea that the aim of lesbian and gay politics isn't to affirm the separateness of homosexuality, but to end the distinction between homosexuality and heterosexuality. In other words, to make it irrelevant that some people are heterosexual and some are homosexual. Dennis Altman, who was the first writer who attempted to put this theme together in 1971-72, said the aim of gay liberation was to end the homosexual. Not just end the homosexual, but to end the heterosexual, to make that rigid division between people irrelevant, to make it unnecessary to think whether someone was homosexual or heterosexual. But of course, the process of getting to there wasn't to deny the distinction or to deny the hierarchy, the power of heterosexual definition, but actually to mobilize one's strength as lesbian or gay people. Now, that notion that the end, the purpose of radical gay politics, of queer politics, is to make it irrelevant, is to break down the distinction, is one that I think recurs in queer politics more recently, to get away from rigid categorizations. But the tension that's there, of course, is that the only way to get away from rigid dichotomies is actually to mobilize on the basis of one side of that dichotomy. In other words, you can only break the rigid categories by mobilizing as a distinct category, by affirming one's gayness. Now, one of the interesting ways in which I think lesbian and gay politics has developed, as I've already hinted, is to make possible not so much the emergence of a single lesbian or gay identity, which is what we thought in 1970, but a whole explosion of identities, different patterns of being gay or lesbian, a whole sort of subcategorization, a proliferation of sub-identities or of separate identities emerged in the wake of gay liberation. The emergence of distinctive identities around S&M, for instance, the emergence of distinctive identities around particular lifestyles, the emergence of distinctive black, lesbian, or gay identities, all struggling for space, all struggling against other forms of oppression that were identified within the broad category of homosexual expression, oppression. So gay politics, lesbian and gay politics since 1970, has in a sense provided a space for the emergence of a whole host of different possible identities. And that emergence of that space, that possibility of different identities, has been vitally important. Because what it's done is actually to create the possibilities of people defining themselves in different ways for different purposes, of creating that space which has made change possible. What I'm trying to suggest is that in the gay liberation movement from 1970, there was a sort of tension all the time. We didn't realize in 1970, but it's much clearer to us now. A tension that I put abstractly as a tension between, on the one hand, transgression, on the other hand, citizenship. If I could try to explain what I mean. Transgression is a breaking of taboos, a breakdown of inherited values, a challenge all the time to existing values, an attempt also to create alternative values. It revels in shocking, in upsetting, in undermining, in subverting the existing order. And that strand of transgression, I think, has gone through the history of the gay movement ever since and has been a vitally important aspect. And transgression, of course, always needs to find new boundaries to transgress. As certain things become acceptable, then it becomes necessary to break the boundaries, to find new areas of taboos to break. What at one time seemed enormously transgressive, to be open about one's gayness, is today absolutely taken for granted in large parts of our culture, where it's not difficult in certain areas to be lesbian or gay, openly lesbian or gay. What becomes more difficult is to be politically radical with that. But there's always that constant battle with transgression to find new taboos to breach. What we've found over the last 25 years is that Western cultures have proved much more absorbent than we ever anticipated. It's become much more possible to break taboos, to change one's lifestyle, to be different than we ever thought. What in 1970 was highly transgressive for a woman to wear leather, for instance. By 1987, 88, Madonna had sold millions of copies of her book by sort of stylish presentations of herself in transgressive situations. It no longer seemed transgressive when large publishing companies could market a book like that. There's a constant circuit of looking for new taboos to break, and our culture has proved very absorbent. Now, the other side of transgression is what I call citizenship, this moment of citizenship. Transgression is breaking taboos, being constant outsiders, subverting the existing order. Citizenship is about belonging, about inclusion, about fitting in to the existing culture. And citizenship, like transgression, is itself ambiguous. It can be conservative and adaptive. It's about fitting into the existing order as it is. It's about, for instance, formalizing gay marriages, formalizing partnership rights. We've seen examples of this in the United States and parts of Western Europe. Very important for many people. But as we've seen in the history of partnership rights in Western Europe, it's also very limited. Denmark, Netherlands, Sweden have given formal recognition to lesbian and gay partnerships, but they've done it in narrowly defined, limited ways, for example, excluding the possibility of lesbian or gay couples adopting. So there's a form of citizenship which opens the doors, allows you in, but doesn't actually transform its dominant values. But I think there is also another way of looking at this history of citizenship. It's of pushing the boundaries of what it means to belong to a culture. It's of transforming the nature of citizenship, of making it something that's meaningful to those who are hitherto excluded. It's about transforming the nature of belonging in society. What Ken Plummer has recently called the notion of intimate citizenship, of citizenship which is concerned with our private experiences, our private desires, about allowing lifestyle experiments in living. And I think it's that sort of, to sum up what I'm trying to say, I think it's this marriage, this conflict and this marriage between transgression, subversion on the one hand, and citizenship as a transforming notion of what it is to belong on the other, that is inherent in the history of gay liberation. It's the tension in gay liberation, Britain. But nevertheless, at the same time, the sort of the energy of gay liberation, which has made possible the transformation of many of our lives. Let me just conclude briefly. I think it's very easy for those of us who were involved in gay liberation and who remember the aspirations, the sort of radical, utopian even, dreams of gay liberation, to forget how much has been achieved over the last 25 years. And any critique of the existing order, any critique of the limits of campaigns, the limits of change, have to start with that memory of how much has actually changed. I would argue that the gay liberation movement of 1970-71 was the seed from which many of the things we take for granted today have developed. They've developed, however, and perhaps inevitably, not in the way we expected. For many of us, around about 1970, we thought the gay liberation was part of this explosive new radical movement that within 4 or 5 years would transform the world, end capitalism, inaugurate the socialist transformation, and change all our lives. It didn't quite happen like that. But I think it's very important in trying to hold on to the lessons of 25 years to remember, as I said, what has changed and what is constantly coming onto the agenda that it was impossible to think of as being necessary to the agenda 25 years ago. If you think of two issues which have been important in the last few years, the whole question of adoption rights by lesbian and gay partners, or the question of gays in the military, they weren't even thought of as issues that was important to discuss 25 years ago. When we confront the difficulties, the problems of changing things today, we have to realize that what we want to change today have emerged in the context of 25 years of history. It's not as if the 25 years haven't happened. A lot has been achieved in those 25 years, which have thrown up new problems, new challenges, which have to be confronted in new ways. Gay liberation, as a context, made that possible. Many of the ideas which are part of the culture today came together for the first time in that short history of the Gay Liberation Front. But of course it wasn't GLF as an organisation, an institution that achieved that. What did achieve the changes were the, first of all, the scores, then the hundreds, then the thousands, and now the hundreds of thousands of people who are involved in the various aspects of the lesbian and gay culture that we know today, engaging in what I've called everyday experiments in living. Those early meetings were perhaps scores or hundreds of people. The first gay liberation, first pride marches, 1971-72, had perhaps a few hundred people on them. Last year's Pride in Hackney had perhaps 250,000-300,000 people in the fields. It's been an enormous transformation of the possibility of being lesbian or gay. I personally feel that none of this could have happened without that sort of spark of gay liberation. On the other hand, that spark of gay liberation couldn't have happened unless it actually touched the needs and the experience of lesbian and gay people in their hundreds of thousands. So to sum up that experience, I think what Gay Liberation Front did was to create the space, a small space at first, which many people, today probably in their millions all over the Western world, have managed to broaden to create the possibilities of being lesbian or gay today. Okay, thanks.
So Professor Weeks will take a few questions for 10 or 15 minutes or so, if there's someone who'd like to ask a question.
In particular, the very word gay, which had been a subcultural term up to 1969-70, as a result of public activity, it became a public term.
In the shorthand I used, that was, you know, one of the things I was trying to convey. I mean, what gay historians in the United States have amply illustrated in recent books is the extent to which what happened in 1969 in New York was actually dependent upon what had been happening for perhaps 20 or 30 years earlier in the United States. Even the word gay, actually, in the United States was used in a much broader sense by the 60s than it was in Britain. It was already, I'm just reading George Chauncey's book on gay New York at the moment, and he shows that the word gay was being used in newspapers even in America in the 1960s. So when the movement that was set up after Stonewall, the Gay Liberation Front in New York, it was using a word that had a sort of subcultural echo, obviously, but also had a wider echo in the United States. The history here was different. The word gay in Britain was very much a sort of subcultural term. It implied a asserted sort of snooty queer in the 1960s, to my memory, living through the 60s in London, didn't have the same sort of wide usage in the homosexual communities in Britain. The dominant word used by gay men in the 60s, of course, was queer, universally used by gay men in the 1960s. For those of us who came into GLF and who'd seen ourselves as queer before 1970, the rejection of the word queer and the use of the word gay was an affirmation, a rejection of that oppressive, self-oppressing identity that existed before. I mean, that's one of the ironies of queer politics of the last 5 years, that that word which we had rejected as so negative was taken up as a flag of a new sort of radicalism, a new sort of pride, which is why there's so much resistance amongst my generation to the use of queer. So I mean, the word is slightly different usage in both America and here, I think. And I think in Britain, there was much more of this acute hostility to the existing scene in early GLF than there was in the United States. In the United States, Stonewall began on the scene. In London, GLF started here at the LSE. And that sort of suggests a different sort of history of the two countries. But of course, by the mid-70s, essentially, the movement and the scene had come together to create the community. There was a much stronger sense of community. And today on Pride, of course, no one is in the least startled that Pride is sponsored by breweries as well as by other large companies. So it is, in a sense, now a community coming out that's happening, much more than a movement, oppositional movement to the existing gay world. But that's why I wanted to stress that in British GLF, I think there was this coming together of different strands, the subculture, the left, and, of course, what had developed in the gay world itself, which I think was something peculiar to British experience. Yeah. Well, there may be others here who were involved in both in the late 60s, early 70s. You can add to what I say. But the early gay liberation front meetings here at LSE probably had about a quarter or a third women in them until the women formed, not all the women, but some women walked out. Now, some of those women who were involved in early GLF were already involved in feminism. But many of them came into GLF because they felt, at that stage, the feminism wasn't directly addressing their needs as lesbians. So there were sort of different motives involved. And I think part of the reasons for the split in GLF, 1971, 72, when women left, was because by then they felt that the women's movement was much more open to thinking about sexuality, as well as about broader issues about women's position in society. So I think GLF always had a slightly ambivalent relationship with the women's movement. In one sense, the women's movement, which started a year before gay liberation, was a model for gay liberation. We developed consciousness-raising groups, for instance, in the same way as the women's movement had. We stressed the person as political. We were very influenced by many of the early feminist texts that were coming out in Britain. Shulamith Firestone's book, The Dialectics of Sex, I think it's called, was very influential in early GLF in Britain, as well as in that moment of the feminist movement. So there was interminglings. But, of course, the main energy, the main focus of GLF was male, despite the valiant efforts of many women, because you know the whole history of homosexuality in Britain, as other parts of the world, was that the male experience had been much more public, had been much more obvious than the female, because the law, because social position of men, etc., all sorts of reasons we know. And therefore it tended, which is why many women left, it tended to be a movement that seemed preoccupied with male interests. And of course many men in the gay movement were misogynistic, as many men in the gay world today are misogynistic. And it's this odd relationship between being masculine and being gay that was one of the tensions in early GLF, and of course continues to be a tension. It has to be said at the same time that many feminists were hostile to gay politics, which is why many women who came into gay liberation felt alienated from feminism. So there was a sense of affinity, of alliance, but also a sense that the agendas were different in those early days, and I think that's continued in many ways since. Sorry, yeah. Well, I mean, as I suggested in my talk, if 25 years ago I'd been asked to forecast what I'd be saying now, I wouldn't have forecast anything that has happened. My vision of what could happen was completely out of kilter with what has happened for all sorts of reasons. I can't foretell the future, nor actually do I think that the easy dissolution of the division that we anticipated 25 years ago is possible in the sense that we anticipated it then. What I do think is possible and achievable and is happening is what I briefly described in my talk as this proliferation of other identities, where what matters isn't so much the homosexual, heterosexual divide, although that's still there, but the sort of affinity groups, the identities around S&M, for instance, around being people with HIV or AIDS, the things which are based around particular experiences, which in some cases, like around AIDS, can actually, in some groups, break down the heterosexual, homosexual division anyway. There are different experiences which may be rooted in the history of sexuality, of heterosexuality and homosexuality, which could be transformed by that. I think there's a much greater flexibility of identities today than we ever contemplated 25 years ago. And I think there's much greater openness in exploring different ways of being what you want to be than along the heterosexual, homosexual divide. That doesn't mean that that's not unimportant. Of course, it's very important, because that divide is reflected in our institutions, our laws, our culture, and so on. But I think there are many more spaces for exploring lifestyles, for what I called experiments in living today, than there were 25 years ago. And that's the sort of direction I anticipate things going. But who could tell? 16 years ago, when Thatcherism triumphed in this country and Reaganism in the United States, we all anticipated a massive backlash towards lesbian and gays and feminism, and to some extent it happened. But one of the paradoxes that I think none of us had anticipated is that backlash, that attempted backlash, actually, far from weakening a sense of lesbian and gay community or identity, has actually strengthened it. Because the very sense that there's something to oppose actually creates a much stronger sense of identity. And, you know, Clause 28, what was it, in 1987, 88, far from weakening lesbian and gay experience in this country, actually enormously strengthened it. Despite the more oppressive law that was on the statute book. So I think there's always this paradox that hostility, rejection, oppression, prejudice, far from weakening a sense of lesbian or gay identity, actually strengthens that. And looking back, you can see that throughout the whole history of homosexuality since the 19th century. Yeah? Made the tea. Yes. Well, I think. Sorry? Yeah. Well, you know, I mentioned the counterculture at the beginning of what I said and how important it was that, in a sense, the counterculture reached lesbian and gays, because one of the criticisms of the counterculture of the 60s by women was precisely that when there was this liberated lifestyle and sex was supposed to be ever ready, it tended to be men who were ever ready and women who had to service them. And the whole left and the counterculture in the 60s, early 70s was still heavily patriarchal. Perhaps it still is. And there was a sense that the whole emphasis on nature, which was very important in the 1960s, you be yourself, you be natural, tended to fit into the assumption that there was a natural dichotomy between men and women, and that men did this and women did that. So it's not surprising, given that background, which is pretty embedded in our Western culture, that that should have been reflected in gay liberation. And of course it was there. My memory very much is, though, that there was a constant effort to learn about this, to try to combat it, to struggle against it. The struggles were often failures. But it was very much part of the culture of gay liberation from the beginning, that men and women had to understand each other better, and men particularly had to change their lifestyles, change their patriarchal attitudes. That was a very important strand. Whether it succeeded, perhaps only the women can tell us, but it was there.
Over the last 5 or 6 years...
Sorry, I missed the beginning.
Over the last five or six years, I've been very conscious of an increasing presence of lesbians in the world of AIDS. Is this something that you have noticed?
Well, if you go back to the early 1980s, with the first emergence of HIV and AIDS, first of all in the States and then here and elsewhere, you find that, by and large, official bodies, official medicine, the state, hoped that the whole problem would go away and it was something they didn't have to deal with. It wasn't until 1986 put any real money into fighting AIDS, and it was the late 80s before much official support was given to community-based organizations in this country. So in those early days, it was the initial response to AIDS, the whole practice of safer sex, the development of a culture of safer sex, the whole emergence of self-help groups, of buddying and so on, was actually on the initiative of people within the lesbian and gay world itself. The lead was by and large taken by gay men who were most directly affected. But lesbians were there right from the beginning working with gay men. It's sometime in the mid-80s, I can't remember exactly when, I went to talk to a group about in Manchester about HIV and AIDS in relationship to men. That was the topic. It was during World AIDS Day or whatever preceded World AIDS Day. And what was absolutely striking there was that there were a large number of gay men and there were women, both lesbian and straight women. There were no straight men there whatsoever. Straight men have never seen it, or didn't see it in the 80s, as their problem at all. And it was women working with gay men who set up the community-based organisations which made possible a rational response to HIV and AIDS in this country in the first 5 years of the crisis. So I think lesbians have always been there in the work against AIDS, and a vital component of the mobilisation against AIDS. So I don't think anything remarkably has changed over the last 5 years, actually, on that front. In fact, I did a research project on this recently, and one of the things that people commented on was the large number of straight women that were now coming into community-based work around AIDS. And many of the people who've been there since the beginning, lesbian and gay activists particularly, felt that this was a sort of do-gooding response from straight women. But there's always been a sense that lesbians have been there right from the beginning, I think. Sorry, I can't hear you, sir. Well, I think the early gay liberation was ambivalent about this because, on the one hand, because of this history of gay liberation and where it came from, I think there was very much a rhetoric of anti-racism and supporting black power and so on. It was part of the culture of gay liberation because we saw the emergence of militant black power in the States in the 60s as a forerunner of what was happening in gay liberation. And we sort of, we hang on to the words of leading black militants in the late 60s, early 70s, in gay liberation. We saw, in a sense, what was happening as an extension of radicalism through black organizations to women, to lesbian and gays. I mean, there was almost that sense that we had a common struggle against racism, against patriarchy, against capitalism, and so on. That was very much there as part of the culture. The problem was then, and it remains a problem, how you enact that anti-racist rhetoric in your personal practice. And of course, people in gay liberation were, as I said earlier, they're misogynistic, but they were also racist, and that's continued to be an element in the gay world. You can't deny that. the struggles against racism, or the struggles against patriarchal power, or the struggles against gay oppression are different struggles. They may be related, but people put different emphasis on different things depending on where they come from. So the practice of anti-racism was never lived up to its rhetoric. I think what's happened since the late 70s, early 80s is is a shift in the whole sense of what this politics is about. I stressed identity as an important element of gay politics. Since the late 70s, early 80s, actually articulated best by black lesbians in the United States at first, and subsequently much wider, is this whole notion of identity politics, that groups should organize around and establish an identity around their own sense of oppression and struggling around that. And we saw during the 80s, again, a whole proliferation of of different groupings, black lesbians, of black gay men, African American, Asian, Native American in the States, and whole proliferation in this country around different experiences of being black and gay. So sort of a spreading out, which led in some cases to separatism, but also a searching for what people had in common as well as different. And I think this balance between what we have in common around a common oppression and what we have different, what we experience as different, through different experiences of oppression, whether you're Jewish or black or whatever, has been another tension within the gay liberation movement, but also within radical politics more widely. How you find a common basis for what we can find in common, and yet you can live out your difference at the same time, I think is actually the fundamental problem of radical politics, leftist politics of all sorts today. So, no, it was not resolved in those early days. But I think, again, it was one of those issues which were, in a sense, put on the agenda in those days and which we're still living through the consequences of.
We might stop there, but we'd like you to continue the discussion on the sixth floor of this building, where we'd be very happy to give you all a drink, which is the custom after public lectures. So we would welcome you there. It just remains for me to thank Professor Geoffrey Weeks for a wonderfully celebratory lecture. It's a great occasion. We've been very pleased to host this lecture, and we thank you very much for coming to give it.
My pleasure.